Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors.
Today on the show, I'm so excited to have open source contributor Steve Klavnik on the show. Steve, you want to say hi?
Hi, everybody. How's it going? I'm glad to be here.
I'm so glad you're here, too. So, Steve, we have actually met before. Did you know that?
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember specifically where, but at some point I remember meeting you.
Yeah, we've met actually on three different occasions in the past 2 years.
Cool. And with the amount of travel and conferences I go to, I'm usually really great at faces and terrible with names, which is really awkward because I'm like, hey, you, how's it going since that time we hung out that one time? So, yeah.
So this is the thing. The first time that I met you, you came as a guest speaker to the Flatiron School. And I don't remember anything that you said. But I remember your hair being really, really cool.
Thanks. Yeah.
And I was like, man, his hair is really cool.
It basically was like a mohawk, but it's so long that it doesn't look like a mohawk because I didn't put it up.
No, I love that. That was awesome. And the second time was at Manhattan JS. You spoke right before I did. And I was hoping you'd stay for my talk, but I think you had to leave. And then the third time was randomly at a co-working space. I think it was called Impact Hub.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
So what's interesting about this is we've met a couple times, and I just love the fact that you are so accessible to like the regular community of, you know, developers. Because, you know, the first time we met, it was like a month into my coding journey, and the fact that you were still so involved and you were so personable and you came to speak at, you know, just a regular old meetup and you were hanging out at a co-working space. You seem very accessible to the community.
Yeah, thanks. I try to be, just because, you know, I like people and I hope people like me. So, you know, I don't think like holding myself away is a good way to, you know, live your life. So I moved to New York for a reason, right? It's like one of the biggest cities in the world. So you can meet a lot of people and hang out and stuff. So
right. That's a recent move for you, right?
Yeah, it's been about a year and a half now. And I really, really like it. I moved from San Francisco.
And you like it? We're treating you well here?
Yeah, definitely. It's great. I love Brooklyn.
So what I love about how accessible you are is that you're a pretty big name in the Ruby community, at least. You know, you were a Rails contributor. Are you still a Rails contributor?
This month actually marks about 2 years since I committed to Rails, anything specific. Mm-hmm. So it's been a little while.
Oh, wow.
But I'm still, but this is one of the interesting things I'm sure we'll get into later about like the way that open source is perceived versus the way that it's actually done. So like I was never on Rails core, but I had commit access to Rails. And so I still get introduced at conferences as like Steve Rails core member, even though that's not strictly true, which is like funny and interesting the way that people perceive your work versus the work you actually do. So I'm still around the Ruby and Rails communities, even though I've been putting in a lot of work on Rust. And that's pretty much why I stopped working on Rails, is because I found Rust to be more interesting and I've devoted more of my time to it recently.
So I think you bring up a really interesting point around kind of the structure of how you can contribute to open source projects. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that structure looks like?
Yeah. So a lot of people think that open source is just about the code. And while that's definitely true in many senses, a lot of people are starting to gain more appreciation for the fact that there's a lot more than just code in open source. So, for example, most of my open source work, at least in the last 3 or 4 years, has been largely about writing documentation. And partly that's because I almost got an English degree and I just really like writing in general. But it's also because documentation is one of those things that people always want to have but never want to actually make. And so you can make your open source project be like perceived as much more professional than others if you have really good documentation and your users really, really appreciate really good documentation. And so that's like one example of something that people don't initially think of when they think about contributing to open source. And another one is things like running conferences and like being available on IRC or Slack to answer questions. And so there's a lot of different ways to contribute that aren't strictly code related, which is also interesting. And so I've been trying to do more of those and bring that stuff to other people's attention more, that like those people are just as equally contributing to open source as people who write the code themselves.
Yeah, when we had John Rezig on, you know, a couple of months ago, he talked about how that was a really big reason why jQuery did so well, because they had really, really good documentation.
Yep. It just makes sense, right? Like, it's easier to use things when you know how to use them and you don't have to figure it out yourself.
Yeah.
Even on projects I've written, when I come back to them a couple months later, if I didn't write any documentation, I end up getting really mad at myself because I'm like, I don't remember how to use this and I even wrote it in the first place.
Right. Imagine all the people who didn't write it and don't know how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So tell me about your contributor journey. How did you get involved in open source?
So I'm one of those people, I don't like talk a whole lot about my history just because I'm so stereotypical and I don't think that it's necessarily like accurate, but I was one of those people that started programming when I was very, very young. And so I didn't actually end up getting involved in open source until like kind of the end of college. And pretty much the reason I started doing that was because I was very active in reading about stuff online in programmer communities. Like, I joined Twitter relatively early and stuff like that. And I saw people always talking about open source, and I had used some open source tools. And so I was like, oh, I should start, you know, contributing on these. You know, one time I found a bug in Rails and was like, I should be able to fix this myself. Let's see if I can, you know, figure it out. But where it really started for me was Hackety Hack. I don't remember how many people remember Why the Lucky Stiff, because it's been a while since he's been active in the programming world. But a long time ago, there was this guy, and his name is Y, like W-H-Y-Y. And he did a lot of really interesting things around programming and Ruby specifically that were much more like art, where code was the medium, than it really was like code itself. And so he decided eventually to quit publicly programming altogether. He sort of deleted all of his online repositories and his Twitter account and all that stuff. And so since his projects were so important, everyone in the Ruby world sort of said like, okay, let's find new people to take over these projects. And I thought one project of his, Hackety Hack specifically, was the most important project and a really important thing. Hackety Hack was a programming environment designed to teach people how to program in Ruby. So you get this nice little window and there'd be a tutorial and you could type Ruby code in and hit run and it would just work. And so that was really, really cool. And I really enjoyed it quite a bit. And so I knew that I hadn't really ever worked on open source before. So the person who was organizing which people would take over which projects, I told him, hey, Flip, I would love to help out whoever is going to be working on Hackety Hack. And since I was the first person to mention it, he said, cool, now you're in charge of Hackety Hack. And I was like, no, I don't want to be in charge. I just want to help whoever shows up. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so then the thing was, is that basically nobody else showed up. So there were one or two other people that helped a little bit in the first week or two, but they quickly kind of disappeared. And so it was just left alone with me, this giant code base written by someone who basically didn't exist anymore and no experience maintaining or running an open source project whatsoever. To make this more complicated, because Hackety Hack involved a Ruby program running inside of it, it also had like a large amount of C. So it really wasn't even entirely written in Ruby itself. And so I had done some C programming before, but one of the reasons why I was programming in Ruby is because C is a lower level programming language, and I got sick of all the details involved in doing lower level programming. So I also had to sort of figure that out as well. And so it pretty much was just like, okay, what do I do from here? And so that was like my introduction to the open source world, was very much like this being tossed off the deep end.
Yeah.
And so I actually ended up quitting my job to work on it, which is something I was only able to do because I got a job teaching Ruby. And part of my stipulation for that job was that when I wasn't teaching, I would be able to work on open source for the rest of my work time. And so my boss said that was okay. And so I kind of like started teaching Ruby and Ruby on Rails and working on Hackety Hack. So yeah, that was my trial by fire, basically.
So when you realized that you were not going to get any help on Hackety Hack because no one else signed up to do that, how did you feel?
Well, it was kind of weird because to me, I was like, this is clearly his most important project. So why doesn't anyone else care?
Hmm. And do you think that's what it came down to? People just not caring?
Well, so the thing is this. Open source is really, really based on a lot of people's spare time work, right? Like, very few people are lucky enough to get paid to work on open source. And so when it's your spare time, when you have a project, as I mentioned, it, like, a lot of it was implemented in C, and a lot of Rubyists don't want to write C. So they would see, like, here's a complicated legacy project that's not even written in Ruby. Do I really want to spend my Saturday afternoon fighting with this code base to figure stuff out? And so it really comes down to not so much that people didn't care, so much as they had the exact same reaction as what I had, right? They're like, oh, I don't want to be in charge of this. I just wish that someone was working on it. And so when they saw I was working on it, they were like, oh, cool, Steve's got this. I don't actually need to help. I'll do something else with my Saturday, you know? And so nobody ever said that to me explicitly, but I think that's a way that a lot of open source happens, is that people just like assume that since there are other people doing the work, they don't have to or need to pitch in. And so, you know, there's a lot of that, which is totally legit. I mean, you know, people program all day for their job. They don't necessarily want to do work in their spare time or take off their Saturdays or, you know, things like that. So I think it's just a combination of the complexity of the project, the fact that it wasn't really written in Ruby, and the fact that, you know, people don't have a lot of time, generally speaking. And so it was sort of all those things put together. And it kind of bummed me out for a while. But at the same time, it's much easier when it's only you, right? Like, I don't have to have weekly meetings to decide what direction the project is being taken in. Mm-hmm. I could just kind of do whatever. And, you know, there's nobody like telling me that, oh, you know, this certain aspect needs to get better, or this aspect needs to get worse. And like, you know, you have a lot of control as well. So in some ways it was a lot harder, but in other ways it was also a lot easier. I think it just really kind of depends on how you take it. And, you know, for me, that was just kind of like, I was like, okay, I guess, I don't know. It was just, I didn't want to let it die. Mm-hmm. It was too important to let die.
So it makes sense that being the only contributor, you have all this power, you get to make all the decisions. But at the end of the day, Hackety Hack is meant to serve a community. Right? How did you balance the things that you wanted to do in the roadmap you had in your head with understanding and communicating with that audience?
Well, so one of the problems is that Hackety Hack in general is like especially targeted at children and people who have never programmed before. And so it as somebody who was an experienced programmer and someone who is frankly bad with children, it was just really hard for me to find that audience in the first place. And then second, there was a specific bug that happened on like Windows XP and Windows Vista only. And I didn't own any Windows machines. I knew nothing about Windows programming. And so on a large number of those computers, it would just crash. And the problem is that a lot of the people who were in that audience were using that particular system. So that made it really, really difficult to be able to like, you know, have them be there. And I built a forum on the website, and so there was some discussion on the forum, but in the end, that's sort of why Hackety doesn't exist anymore, is for one reason is just that, like, I didn't have that audience to be able to, like, reach, and I couldn't figure out how to reach them either. Like, it's been getting a lot better in the most recent years, but 5 years ago, there were very few places that were specifically devoted to beginning programmers online. And so, you know, it's really hard when you're like, I don't even know how to reach this audience, you know, whatsoever. So there were some quality issues and there were some audience issues. And so, like, unfortunately today, it's like basically abandoned, which kind of makes me sad. But at the same time, you know, one person can't do control like all of that stuff. You know, it's like it was just too much of a burden.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the lessons you learned working on that first open source project?
The first one was that open source didn't really work the way that I assumed that it worked. Mm. Like, just because you have a project does not mean that people are going to use it. And just because it's open source doesn't mean they're going to help you. And I kind of had always assumed that, like, you know, that's one of the way we talk about open source is like, oh yeah, and all these other people and you get to work with them and they contribute. But I think that, do you know about the concept of the long tail? Have you talked about that on this podcast before?
No, I don't think so. Tell us about it.
So there's this book that was written a long time ago, and I think it was originally about Amazon, and it's called The Long Tail. And the reason it's called the long tail is if you draw, there's like one of those graphs that's, I think the math formula is like 1/x, where when it starts off near the axis, it's like very high, and then it curves down, and it eventually gets really, really close to the x-axis. At the end, it's very small. I don't know if that's a good visual or like, you know, we can link something that shows
we'll
it to the show notes.
Yeah, we'll link to it.
But the thing that they talk about in the long tail is that people assume that the early chunk of the curve is where all the people are. So if you take like the top 10 most popular products that you could sell, say on Amazon, for example, you would think that because they're the most popular, you would make the most money. But it turns out that, like, mathematically speaking, the area under the curve for everything from the like 80th percent down to the, you know, 0%, that's actually a lot more stuff. And so it works the same way with open source as well. Like, there are some well-known open source projects, but there are a lot of really small ones. And I think that overall, like, open source in many ways is like, there's a significant number of projects where there's one or two maintainers, more than there is the projects like the Linux kernel, which, you know, receive thousands of patches a week. So I think a lot of people assume it's the other way around. And that's like, that's why Amazon makes all their money, is because they sell, you know, two copies of 6,000 different products, as opposed to, you know, a lot of a small number of products. And that's also one reason why the like online stores can do so much better than brick and mortar stores sometimes, is because when you have a physical location, you can only carry the most popular products. But when you're like a website, you can, you know, have as many as you have room in the database for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, yeah, I think people think that like all open source projects are big and have lots of contributions, but I don't actually think that that's true. And so we talk a lot about like open source in the large, but not very much about open source in the small. I think there's a lot of maintainers there out that were like me back then saying, you know, I'm the only person on this project. It's kind of lonely. I wish someone would come help me. Yeah.
So did you ever find people to help you?
Well, yeah. So eventually some people have come along, and there's been some work on those projects. And for some of my other smaller projects, occasionally people show up. But one of the really cool things that I kind of learned backwards, being on the maintainer first as opposed to being a contributor first, meant that like when one or two of those people did show up, I was ridiculously thankful, right? Because I'm like, here's someone who's like finally interested in what I'm doing and they want to help, and that's so exciting. And so that's one of the things that I realized now in the other direction is if I see someone's project and I have an issue with it, I'll like open up an issue and be like, hey, I was using your thing today. Here's, you know, this thing that happened. You know, maybe we can talk together about working on a patch or something. And I found that, you know, it's sort of like giving that feeling back, mm-hmm. you know, like I could just say like, oh, here's a problem, whatever, I'm going to use the next package. But I always at least open an issue before I move on to the next one, because even just people say like, wow, I never knew anyone was even using this. Mm. And like the fact that you are using this motivates me to, you know, work on it some more, like fix some bugs or whatever. And so I think that that's also something that's like, if you're looking to get started, instead of trying to join a big giant project like Rails, finding a small gem that you use that only has one or two people working on it means you can have a much, much bigger impact on that smaller project than, you know, being overwhelmed by a really big one.
So you've touched on a lot of things, and a lot of it echoes kind of my understanding of open source over the last few years as well, where at first it sounded very romantic. It sounded like, you know, we're all going to come together in all different parts of the world and build great things, and it's going to be amazing. And then I would hear lots of stories, like you said, where it's actually not a big team. It's one or two people maintaining and, you know, kind of keeping it alive. And I would hear stories of maintainers who burnt out, you know, from putting in a lot of work over a long period of time, not always getting the support they need. Oftentimes, as you mentioned, you're not getting paid. And it makes me wonder, why are so many people excited about open source when it seems to be pretty hard for most people to do happily and to do in the long term?
I think that the reason there is because, like, people see me get on stage at a Ruby conference and give a presentation, but they don't see when I have to answer an email at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning because there's a security vulnerability. They see the like that I have a lot of Twitter followers, but they don't see those times whenever I'm like working on a release and I don't get any sleep because I stay up too late building things. So you kind of only see the really positive ends and you totally miss out on those negative things because those are like more private. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's like also part of it too, I think that, and by definition, like if you're a lonely open source maintainer, that means that nobody has noticed you because you would right. you wouldn't be lonely otherwise, right? So it's kind of like hidden away that these smaller projects and that people struggle with them because that's like part of the problem, you know? So we, it's, I think that the technical name for this effect is called survivorship bias.
Yes.
And that's pretty much, I think, what it really boils down to is that people only see the sort of glamoury side of things. And even then, like, so I went to Rails Israel a couple years back, and at the time, I only had $50 in my bank account. And so, like, I'm doing this international travel and, like, you know, being a speaker, but I had to, like, crash on someone's couch and, like, make sure that I had enough money to eat while I was there. Because, you know, sometimes life gets in the way and I had an unexpected expense pop up and I wasn't going to get paid for another 2 weeks. And so, like, that's the kind of thing that happens sometimes too, where then people will only see, like, oh, Steve is going to fly to another country to speak at some conference, but didn't know that I was, like, flat broke. Mm. And that's also very strange too, you know, when you're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make rent, but I'm going to Germany this week. Or, you know, it's just like a very, very strange thing. That people only see one half of a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there is a net positive effect of the survivorship bias for programmers and people in the coding community?
I think to some degree that it's positive because it gives people something to like aspire to. And, you know, I've been really, really lucky in that I've now made thousands of friends all over the world. And, you know, I wouldn't really give that up for anything else. But at the same time, I think that it's important that we don't over romanticize, you know, the people who are popular. Like, they also make bad decisions and they're just human and there's not anything really special about them other than they've just like persevered at this one particular thing. And that's, you know, a good thing. I'm not saying it's like bad either, but like they're not superhuman. They're just people.
So one thing that you mentioned was that most people working in open source don't get paid for it. You know, you do it because you love it, because you want to do it in your spare time, which in and of itself is a privilege and is a luxury for the people who can do that. Are there ways that people can make open source contributions and actually get paid for it?
So there's a couple different things that you can do. One of them is to be lucky enough to work at a company that supports open source. So for example, right now I work at Mozilla, and basically all of the code that we write is open source. So my day job is open source by definition. However, there are only so many companies out there like that. Previous jobs that I've worked at have basically said, you know, we'll take Fridays to work on the open source projects that we use at this company if you want to like help contribute upstream. So there's a lot of times you can get like kind of those sort of things to, you know, help out. And occasionally there are programs and grants. So, for example, the various Summer of Code organizations will give students money over a summer to work on stuff. And so there are things like that as well. There's a smaller number of things like Patreon. I don't know if you've ever mm-hmm. heard of that.
Yeah, we have
website.
A Patreon.
It tends to be better with like artists than programmers, it seems to me. But there's some people who fund some of their work through things like Patreon. And then a last way, and this is like the super hard mode way, is some people actually have managed to turn open source into their own startups. So one great example of this, and is also interesting from the like politics of open source perspective, is Mike Purim makes the Sidekick gem for Rails.
Mm-hmm.
It does like background job queue stuff. And he actually has a business where he sells extra features for money. So if you download Sidekick, it's 100% free and open source. But if you pay him, I forget how much it is, but if you give him some money, he gives you access to Sidekick Pro, which has additional features that are useful for businesses. And so a lot of people have paid him for that, and he now works full-time on his own little business working on his, you know, Ruby gem.
Good for him.
So sometimes you can do that too, although that's been really hard to pull off. I've thought about trying to do that a number of times, and I've never wanted to take the leap myself. So, you know, it's just like, We'll see how it goes in the future. But the thing is, it's really hard to ask people for money. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, maybe it's just like the way I was raised or whatever, you know, but it's like really, really hard to say, like, I did this work, please pay me, mm-hmm. especially when there's so many people doing this work for free. Mm-hmm. You know, people are sort of like reluctant to pay at times, because also a lot of the time people like companies have orders of magnitude more money than people do. And so the really way that you do that is you get companies to pay you, because like a person paying $1,000 a month is a lot of money, but like to a company paying $1,000 a month is like sometimes, you know, under a manager's discretionary budget mm-hmm. where they don't even need to report it to upper management that they're paying this. Right.
Yep.
So that's like the thing too, is that you have to figure out how to ask companies for money, and then evolve sales skills, which, you know, are not like kind of the opposite of why, you know, if you learn programming, it's because you didn't go into a field like sales. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to like manage the skill set that's a totally separate skill set. And, you know, that's really hard. It's hard to be good at programming and good at sales at the same time, mm-hmm. right? Like, yeah. They're just very, very different things.
Very different. Yeah. And I feel like if you're going into open source because you want to code and then you have to figure out how to sustain yourself, then, you know, it's two jobs basically that you've taken on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear more about different business models around open source. The one that I'm most familiar with is what I guess, you know, Discourse does, where, you know, if you can look at the code, you can host it yourself. But if you want them to host it and you want them to kind of take care of that for you, then you pay a monthly fee for that. That's probably one of the most popular ones I've heard.
Yeah, we do that. The Rust project actually pays Discourse for that. So, you know, so I'm a strong believer in that model, because, you know, we actually do give some of our money that way. Another one that I'd say is probably the most popular overall, and maybe that's incorrectly speaking, but I'll say it's the one I've heard about the most, is called Open Core. Mm. So what Open Core means is that you generally distribute your project under the GPL, which is the free software license, the premier free software license. And the thing about the GPL is that it basically says that if you change this code and share it with anyone else, it also must be under the same license, which means that companies can't take your project, make the source code secret, and then add stuff and sell it to other people. Mm-hmm. So it ensures that your code is always open source, basically, even if other people use it for money. And so that's really great for a lot of things. Like, most of the software running on my computer uses the GPL, but a lot of businesses are very terrified of giving their code away for free. Mm-hmm. So what Open Core does is they say, anyone can download the software under the GPL, but if you pay us, we'll give it to you under the BSD instead. And the BSD just basically says, don't sue us for anything. We don't make any guarantees that this is like a quality product. Like, do whatever you want with it, basically. And so that removes that restriction to keep the code open source. And so a lot of companies work this way. So, for example, MySQL at least did. Now they've been bought by Oracle. I'm not sure if that's still true or not, but that was the way that kind of worked. MongoDB is another example of a product which does this this way. So you can download their code for free, but only if you follow this more restrictive. And some people call it a restrictive license, and that's complicated politically. But I really love the GPL, and a lot of people, especially in the Ruby world, hate it. Mm-hmm. And so, there's a really interesting discussion you can get into around the concept of freedom and like positive versus negative freedoms. Mm. So a license like the BSD is, some people will say it's more free because it lets you do whatever you want with the source code. But a GPL person would say that GPL is more free because by restricting the rights of people who want to make the code proprietary, your code will always be free.
Ooh.
So for example, like me as a user, if I purchase some GPL software from a developer and there's a bug with it, I can fix it because I've access to the source code. Whereas if I purchased a closed source piece of software, I've lost my freedom as a user to actually fix and improve that software itself. So there's this question about like, do you give more freedom to the developers or do you give more freedom to your end users? And that's kind of how the like BSD versus GPL thing kind of plays out, usually speaking. Is that like, because our libraries are usable for other programmers, we're interested in letting other programmers do whatever they want with it, as opposed to, you know, our users who eventually use our software.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, it's like a very complicated debate that's been going on for, so both of those licenses were basically invented in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's just been a continuous source of, you know, arguments where people will be like, well, no, I'm more free because I have no restrictions. Like, well, I'm more free because someone can't take your work and then not, you know, compensate you for it. And like, you know, it's just like one of those things where different people have different opinions. And so people in the Ruby world are very pro BSD and MIT, which is basically the same license, and very anti GPL, which is, I think, is really unfortunate because I like the GPL a lot.
So I want to get back to your story a bit. How did you go from Hackety Hack, which feels like a very big project to take on as your first open source project, to being a Rails contributor?
So I had mentioned that when I started working on Hackety, I had taken that job to teach Ruby and Rails, right? And so so I was doing that for a while. And basically what that involved was companies would pay me and my boss to go fly to their office on a Monday. We'd run class for 4 or 5 days and then fly home on a Friday. And so what was interesting about that is as I started to teach new people Rails, you know, all the time, I would notice the things that they had struggles with, like what concepts were difficult for them. And so, and I started realizing that I'd end up explaining the same things like over and over. And at that point I was like, this stuff belongs in the Rails documentation. And also I think that I started working on it a little bit too, because, you know, people like to look up to the people that work on Rails. And so I wanted to be one of those people. So what do? You work on Rails. Mm-hmm. And like, it was the thing that I had used the most over the past couple of years as well. So it was a thing I knew very well. I like to say, and a lot of people say this, this isn't something I came up with, but if you can't find something to complain about the thing that you're using, you don't know it well enough yet.
Ooh.
Because like, once you truly know something, you can see its flaws mm-hmm. as well as its good things. And so to me, like I had had a lot of complaints about Rails because I'd been using it so much mm-hmm. over the last couple of years. And so the next natural step is to stop complaining and start improving.
What were some of the things that you heard complaints about?
Well, so probably the most visible and obvious thing is that have you typed rake routes on a Rails app anytime recently?
Mm-hmm.
So you know how it displays all the routes with like here's the path and here's the URL. And there's like a column header on the top of those columns.
Mm-hmm.
That column header was added by me. Because a long time ago, that column header wasn't there. And the reason it wasn't there is because of an old Unix philosophy where basically like if you don't print out a lot of extra information because it makes combining tools more complicated. So for example, if you wanted to run grep, the searching program on the output of rake routes, you would have to filter out those headers. So the natural thing to do is not include the headers and just include the data. But again and again and again, I saw newbies get confused as to like which column means which thing. So sometime back in the Rails 4 days, I like added those headers to the top. And then magically, I stopped getting questions about it because people would remember because now there's headers, right? So that's like probably the most prominent example, I guess, of something that I contributed to Rails. I did a lot more documentation work than actual code work. So a lot of the stuff on the guides and a lot of the API documentation were like things that I worked on.
So it's interesting because when we talked about Hackety Hack, you mentioned that one of the hardest parts about it was not having that direct access to your audience, which were mostly kids using Windows products. And now as a teacher, you are working with your, in a sense, your audience. Sounds like every day.
Right. Maybe not every day because, you know, business isn't great all the time, but a lot of the time anyway. A significantly more amount than most of the people who use Rails all the time, right? Like most people type Rails new once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so therefore they don't think about like, you know, how to make Rails new easier, how to make it better. And so when you like teach new people, you see that beginning experience a lot more. Definitely.
So when you were contributing to Rails, what was the process like? You notice this problem, you have a solution in mind. What was the next step?
Yeah, so each project works a little bit differently, but Rails follows a very common process for doing this. So if you have a new problem and there isn't currently an issue open, you can open a new issue. And if you accidentally open up a duplicate, someone who knows better will tell you and, you know, close your version, which it's still nicer People get worried about like saying that they filed a duplicate issue, but to me as a maintainer, I would much rather have five people report an issue than zero people report an issue. So I always try to like look first and see if I can find anything, but if I can't find it right away, I'll just open up another issue and say, hey, here's this problem. So you can do that, especially that's a good path if you're not interested in fixing the problem. But if you're interested in fixing the problem, you can try to figure out what's going on yourself and then just open a pull request directly. So because I was working on documentation, there wasn't a whole lot of complicated stuff around like tests and figuring out how that stuff worked. And so I would usually just open up a pull request with like, here's a better explanation for what this function does. And then what happens is somebody comes along and they review your pull request. Rails has gotten a lot better in recent years with this, and it's actually something that we do on the Rust project as well, that they kind of Rails adopted afterwards. And I'm really excited to see more open source projects adopt this. So what happens is we have a bot that we call High Five, and it watches for new pull requests, and it knows everyone who's ever submitted a pull request before. And if you're opening a pull request for the first time, the bot will see the pull request and leave a message saying, hey, so-and-so, thank you so much for opening up this pull request to Rails. Somebody or possibly, and they'll mention someone who's a committer and say, like, Steve or whoever will be along with you sometime shortly. And then it will ping me to say, like, hey, a new pull request got open and you should review it.
That is so nice.
Yeah, right? It's, like, significantly increased the friendliness of things. And it also means that if I am bad at checking my email, I will still have a pull request that's assigned to me, you know, in GitHub, so I can see that, like, oh, hey, there was this pull request, and like at least somebody will have to look at it at least once. And sometimes it'll, you know, since it picks at random, sometimes it will choose something that you're not an expert at. So, for example, on Rust, I write documentation, and so if somebody submits a pull request that's like fixing the type system or something, and it picks me, I'm like, I don't know anything about this, and then I'll say, hey, you know, Nick, or you know, hey, Alex, could you review this instead? And so at least it makes sure that someone is paying attention and that you get that kind of instant feedback. And so then after that's happened, that person or whoever decides to review it, and sometimes random other people as well, will like read your pull request and they'll leave comments and say like, oh, hey, could you maybe do this instead? Or because I work on documentation, a lot of times for me, it's like, hey, our standards for this project say one space after a period, or you should use single quotes instead of curly quotes in that instance. And so they'll give you feedback, and then you can like update the pull request by adding more commits to it. And then eventually at some point they'll either say like, yes, we want this, or no, we don't. And if they want it, they'll click merge and you've just contributed to an open source project.
So what I love about that is, you know, I've heard the saying, I can't remember who said it, but someone pretty well known in programming said that they're too busy to be nice when it comes to open source and dealing with pull requests. And you fix that by just having a bot be nice.
Yeah.
Like it didn't right. feel like it was that hard.
That's helpful. And it's also, so what's interesting about, I definitely think that too busy to be nice is like really mean. But I will say that sometimes you can accidentally not be nice because you are busy. So like if I get, you know, 15 pull requests in a week that all require a lot of attention, maybe I'll forget to review one of them for a couple days. And then the person will be like, hey, did you forget about me? Or, you know, maybe if I'm reviewing so many things all at once, I start getting a little more short with my messages. And one of the interesting things about text and communicating over text is that you can say something that you don't think is mean that other people think is mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really unfortunate too, you know? So if I've been really busy, maybe I don't type out all of the normal like, hey, exclamation point, thank you, exclamation point. And I'm just like, please fix this one thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's just because I'm in the flow of working and that can come across as like being upset or angry, even though I'm not. So I think that there's like a little more subtle things than that slogan necessarily says. But a lot of times the meanness is accidental more than like intentional. But occasionally it's intentional and those people are terrible.
Yeah, I have that same problem too, because a lot of times, especially if I'm responding on my phone, I just, you know, don't want to write very long sentences and I sound short and I don't mean to be short. So I just add smiley faces to everything. And
that seems to help. Emoji have been a wonderful
yes.
side effect of this, you know, because
yes.
you can like easily add some extra emotion and, you know, it's not too bad.
Yeah, exactly. So you've mentioned a few different roles in open source. You talked about a committer, a contributor, a maintainer. Can you tell us a little bit more about what these different words mean and how you end up in different roles?
Yeah. So one thing that people have a misconception about with open source when they first hear about it is they say, like, anyone can commit code to the project. Well, what happens if somebody shows up and deletes all your code? And it's like, well, while everyone can help out on a project, that doesn't mean that everyone will. So most projects have this thing where basically it says who is allowed to commit code into the repository. And so that used to be called a commit bit, because it would be like flipping a 0 to a 1 in a configuration file of, like, you know, this person is not allowed versus this person is allowed. And so people call the set of people who are allowed to push code are called committers. And so that's like a big leap in terms of, if you're a contributor, that means that you have given code to the project or you've worked on code, but it doesn't mean that you have the rights to just automatically put your code into the source tree. So everyone who is a committer is a contributor, but not everyone who's a contributor is a committer. Ooh. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And that's a common path where, like, as you gain more prominence in the project, you'll go from a contributor to a committer, because, like, someone will say, hey, you've done a lot of great work here. Now that you've demonstrated that you're, you know, competent, I trust you. Here's commit access. And there are some projects that even give you commit access on your very first commit. Like, they only review your first one, and then after that, it's you're totally given responsibility to do, you know, what you want, which is also kind of cool. And so different projects have different amounts of ceremony and requirements around who gets access to that commit bit. And so another, one of the last things that you mentioned in that is a maintainer. So the maintainers are the set of committers who are currently working on the project. So for example, with Rails, I'm a committer, but I'm not a maintainer, because I still have access. Like, I could tab over my terminal right now and push some code to the Rails repository, and that would still work. But since I'm not actively doing that, I'm no longer doing maintenance, so I'm no longer a maintainer. So that's kind of the current, like, the active set of committers. Because, you know, even though you haven't committed in a while, maybe someday you come back. And so generally people don't, like, removing your commit bit, allowing you to not commit on a project anymore, is a very, like, I don't say mean, but it usually means you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
And so if you haven't contributed in a while, there's no harm with leaving you to have access to the project if you never did anything wrong. So a lot of projects will just never bother to remove people who don't work on it anymore, because that's kind of like a bad thing that you do to bad people, not just like a, you got busy, so you stopped working on this kind of thing.
Interesting.
And people change, so you might even come back to it. So just because you haven't worked on something for a while doesn't mean that, you know, like, for example, a lot of people are like, well, I used to help on open source, but then I had a kid, and so I went away for a year or two, and then I started working on it again. And so it would be kind of like, you know, too much effort. Not too much effort, but, like, there are legitimate reasons why people take breaks. And so you don't want to just remove their commit bit just because they had some other part of their life that interfered with their ability to contribute.
It's almost like there is open source etiquette. There.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's a lot of etiquette. Because, you know, ultimately it's about people. And whenever you have multiple people working on a thing, there is politics and etiquette. You can't get away from it.
Mm-hmm. So another thing that you've mentioned, I think at the top of the interview, was a core contributor.
Yeah. So some teams have an extra level on top of, like, committer that may or may not be the same as maintainers, that is called a core contributor. And basically, that means that there's some sort of special, distinguished thing that you have done that it means that you've gone, like, above and beyond the people who normally just contribute. And oftentimes, that means that there's increased amount of responsibility, as well as an increased amount of, like, decision-making involved. So, and it also depends on the project, too. So the way that it works with Rails is if you're part of Rails core, or I guess I should say this is based on Rails from 2 years ago, so maybe they've changed it a little bit. But they have separate chat rooms for committers and contributors and core team members. So like sometimes decisions are made only by the core team, and that may not include everyone who's actually a contributor or a committer, because like big decisions about things that are coming up, or like sometimes maybe, for example, you'll have something that you want to work on in secret for various reasons. And sometimes you want to have a discussion only with the people who are the most active on the project and not just solicit opinions from literally every person who's ever used this thing. And so a lot of times open source projects will create these kind of siloed individual places for people of those varying permissions, so you can have the right amount of discussion for whatever thing it is that you're, you know, working on. And so that's also, you know, kind of part of it as well. I know a lot of core teams also have a private room because it lets them like blow off steam sometimes. And so like if you're on the core team of a project, you're a politician in many ways. Mm. When you talk in public, people pay attention and they listen to what you have to say. And so if you're just like having a bad day and you're getting angry, you can like blow off some steam in the core team room. And the other people that are there are also the people that work there all the time. And so, you know, it's kind of like a back channel in many ways that lets you like not be that politician for a minute. And I think that's important in many instances. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's also part of it as well.
So if I want to get to a point where I'm a core contributor in, you know, on a big project, how would I do it? Is it just a matter of being persistent and, you know, always being helpful and making those pull requests and kind of hoping I get noticed? Is it about getting to know the people on that project on a more personal level? Like, what does that look like?
So each project works differently, so I can't tell you something that works on all of them. But what I will say is that the general path is the same, which is basically just get more involved. And the more you get involved, the more that path becomes clear. Now, there's also been a little bit of push lately to like explicitly define process around how you move amongst these different groups, because a lot of times it's just completely ad hoc. Like people don't actually think about it and there's no written down rules. You just kind of like, you know, people will say like, oh yeah, finally, here you are. You're now a committer instead of a contributor. And that's made in like a semi-arbitrary way, basically. And so a lot of people are moving towards trying to have a well-defined process. And so the project will advertise what that process is if they have one. But as you get more involved in a project by submitting pull requests and stuff, you're just kind of around more and you see more how the project works. And people who are the maintainers will generally notice someone has been contributing a bunch and more often. Like you just, because you work on the project all the time, you see the other people work on projects all the time. And so just generally by getting more involved, it kind of sorts itself out in many ways. Although, obviously some things can like alter and affect that particular, outcome. And that's why people have been trying to move towards a defined process to make it more clear and easy rather than arbitrary. Cause I know that I've definitely have seen, and you know, I'm not saying that this is Rails, it's just like projects in general. I've seen things where people who are more popular get the commit bit earlier than people who don't, just because they're popular. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen people whose maybe work has been underappreciated for a while that I feel like they should be made a committer, but they haven't because they just slipped through the cracks. And so, you know, that's why people have been moving towards like a more explicit process. But each project decides for themselves what that organizational structure looks like and how it's done. So, for example, the Rust project works completely differently than the Rails project does. So I don't know if we want to switch from Ruby to Rust stuff or whatever.
Yeah, let's do that. What are some differences?
So Rust is a programming, I guess for some background, Rust is a programming language that we make at Mozilla. And my job is to write documentation, and I'm on the Rust core team. So the way that Rust works is the process in general is kind of the same. You submit a pull request. There's a bot that hopefully says something, you know, nice and friendly. We try to work through the issues and then, you know, get it merged or not. So all that works the same. But the committer, contributor kind of thing works a little bit differently. So the way that we have it in Rust is there's actually a link on our homepage to this like teams page. And so we have a number of different teams whose focus is in a certain area. And all of them have commits. They're all allowed to commit to the project, but they generally only do it in their area of expertise. So for example, there's a compiler team that just works on the compiler. There's a libraries team that works on the standard library and, you know, other libraries that are important to the Rust project. There's a community team that just helps out when people are trying to run meetups and do things like that. And there's a number of these different teams. And then there's also a core team. And the core team's job is to make sure that if some team is going to do something that affects another team, that they talk about it first. It's like, because if you get too involved in like one specific aspect of the project, you may not know what's going on in other parts of the project. So we're kind of like an oversight, like umbrella team that makes sure that everyone's like playing nice. And we also have like final veto on like those teams are allowed to make their own decisions in their area of expertise, but we may choose to veto those decisions if we want to. And we've never actually done that before, but like there's sort of like that, it's kind of like how in the US government we have the checks and balances system, you know, you learn about in seventh grade. Like
yep.
the core team is kind of the check on everyone else's, you know, activities, just to make sure that nothing happens that we don't like agree with or whatever. So we have like 8 people on the core team and then something like 20 or 30 people on those various sub teams. And that's a lot of people with commit on a project. It's kind of a little bit bigger and like works a little bit differently. And each sub team has a different process for how to get involved with that sub team. We're currently working through defining those specific instances, but it pretty much just boils down to the same thing, like get involved more often. And then at some point it will become appropriate. But we'd like to define that a little bit better. We're working on it.
So are most of the contributors or committers on Rust, are they in Mozilla working full-time as well?
It's actually not that many people. So Mozilla pays 8 people to work on Rust full-time, I think is the number, give or take 1 or 2. But so even if you look at that, it's about half of what I said earlier, right? Like 8 or 10 versus 20 or 30 people. So a lot of them are not full-time on Rust, and that's actually really good. And also the core team specifically, 6 of the 8 people on the core team don't work for Mozilla.
Oh.
And later in the year, I might actually leave Mozilla. We're still trying to figure that out exactly. And so I might make it 3 out of 8 not being working on the team for Mozilla itself. The reason why is that I want to return to teaching.
Really?
And Mozilla is not really going to have a budget for teaching Rust as a job. So I'm probably going to like start a teaching company, and Mozilla will like contract my company to do the job I'm currently doing for like half the time. Mm. And then I will try to find teaching gigs for the other half. So we haven't really determined exactly what that looks like, but it's something that when I joined Mozilla, they sort of always have known and they've been supportive of. Was kind of like, once there's enough people using Rust that I can get a job doing it, like that's what I want to do. And they were like, that sounds great, and we'd love to support you until the time when you're able to do that. So we're not really sure when that time is. And the new year is a great time to try new things, right? So I'm thinking that might be how it works out, but, you know, we'll kind of see.
That's, well, definitely keep us posted on that. I'd love to hear how going back to teaching works out.
Yeah, I hope so. And I still do teach occasionally. There's an organization in New York called Code Now. Have mm-hmm. you heard of them?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so I've been helping out with Code Now since like 4 or 5 years at this point, I think.
Oh, wow.
They used to be in Washington, D.C., and then they moved to New York from D.C., and so I used to help them when they were back in D.C., and so I'm actually helping out in October. There's going to be a Code Now meetup thing, and I'm going to do that. So I still occasionally get the chance to volunteer with them, and you know that's really, really fulfilling. I actually bumped into a former student of mine. I was randomly in the West Village going to see a movie at the Independent Film Theater, and one of my former students walked by and was like, "Oh, hey, Steve, guess what? Like, I'm going to college for programming now."
Aww.
And I was like, "That's really awesome."
Oh, that's great.
I guess some of your listeners might not know about Code Now. Code Now specifically runs trainings for kids in high school from various disadvantaged or underprivileged backgrounds, and gets them a laptop, and we teach them. It used to be Ruby, actually, through Hackety Hack, but I think now they're more focusing on JavaScript. But whatever. The point is that it like gives kids the ability to learn programming and see if it's something right for them, so that they can choose to try to focus their studies or learn something or get a job in the future. So that's been really, really fulfilling. One of my former students got to meet the president recently.
Oh, wow.
Wait, which
of
is
the
cool.
U.S.?
Yeah, of the U.S.
Oh, okay.
He like met Obama. Yeah, exactly, because he was involved in some programming related thing that, you know, was part of Code for America or something. I don't remember the specific details, but it was something where like he got to say hi and shake his hand. And stuff.
That's
like,
awesome.
Yes. You know, that's really fulfilling as a teacher to see your students do well.
Oh, that's great. Actually, I think that'd be a great group to have on the podcast. So maybe I'll reach out to them.
Yeah, definitely. I think that Ryan Seashore is the guy who's in charge, and I'm sure he would love to talk about what he's doing.
Yeah, I will definitely do that. So in your work with these kids, but also your teaching in the past and your future teaching, your upcoming teaching, I imagine you've seen people make their first open pull request. And I think that that first open source pull request can be really, really intimidating, especially if you didn't, you know, start coding until a little bit later in life. Because I think that for, you know, most other jobs, professions, things you want to do, you kind of have to ask permission first. And when you're making a pull request, you're just doing it. Like it's on you to press a button and hope that people like what you do. I'm wondering, how have you seen people get over that initial intimidation to make that first pull request for an open source project?
So one thing that you can do is, before you actually do the work of a pull request, if you're not sure, you can just open an issue, and at least like that, it's still semi-public. Because like the core of this is, most of the time, if you screw up something, it's in private, right? So if I'm trying to work on some program, it's like, you know, a Sunday right now, and it's, you know, the afternoon, and I'm like working on something. If I make a mistake, no one is going to see it because I'm alone in my apartment right now, right? But when you open a pull request, you're sort of putting yourself out there a little bit, and other people can see what you've done.
Exactly.
And so I think that's like the root of why it's really scary, is because, you know, you might end up screwing up in public. So some people just are kind of naturally a little extroverted, and so it doesn't bother them as much. And then other people just kind of like get up the courage to do it, and then it's not as scary as they thought. And so the second one gets easier and the third one gets easier. My first pull request to Rust actually got rejected. And the reason was that I had done everything right, but most projects that use GitHub work on the master branch. And so that's what GitHub defaults you to send the pull request against master. But at the time, and this isn't true anymore, now we just use master, but at the time, you needed to submit a pull request to a totally different branch. And so they ended up saying, like, this looks really great, but we can't accept it because it's to the wrong branch. Please open up a new pull request, like, pointing to the other branch instead. And so it got closed. So
okay, that's an okay reason. That's fine.
Yeah, right. But I mean, just like what I mean to say is that like I also try to share that story and other stories that are similar with people, that it's like it's not a big deal if you screw it up. Because like everyone makes mistakes. So it's not something that's like, I'm not going to say you shouldn't be scared, because I don't like placing that kind of like direction or something on people. But I guess just what I mean is, I think if you give it a try, you will find out that it's not that big of a deal, and it just gets easier every single time you do it. So now I usually end up opening a multiple pull request a day, and sometimes even on projects I've never been to before, just because I've done it so much at this point that I know that the worst thing that's going to happen is someone's going to say no thanks. And while that's like a little disappointing, it's just not that big of a deal. Most projects, the reason that they're open source is they want you to help them. And so they'll be willing to do whatever it takes to like get you to be able to fix anything that you, you know, didn't get right. Because a lot of times if you're new to a project, you may not understand one or two things. And so I've almost universally found that people are willing to work with you on iterating over it. Almost no pull request makes it in without someone finding some little thing wrong and making you fix it. It's like almost universal. There are very few, I would say the only pull requests I usually merge that I don't give any feedback on are when people found out that I've made a typo somewhere and they're just fixing my typos. Those ones are usually pretty good. But you know, every once in a while, you know, usually there's always some kind of feedback. And even for people that have been contributing for a long time, they don't get it right on the first try either. So, you know, that's also something to kind of remember while you're trying to do this. And another solution might be just do it on a smaller project. You know, if it's intimidating to do it on a big one where a lot of people are watching, then just, you know, do it on a smaller one. And you can even practice, because GitHub repositories are free. You could even open up your own project and then send your own pull request and see what it looks like for both sides to get kind of used to the interface and like how to do things and stuff.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. So that's also something. I'm pretty sure that I'd seen a project one time that was like, here's how you can practice doing this stuff. There's a lot of stuff that goes around it too. Like working with GitHub is like another thing you kind of eventually have to like figure out. There's someone who's had a pull request open on Rust for about a month now. And the only reason it hasn't been merged is because they need to rebase their pull request, which is something if you haven't done this before, basically what happened was after we went through our long process of fixing all the things, they had like 20 or 30 commits that were mostly just like, oops, fix my earlier mistake. Oops, fix my earlier mistake. And so a rebase is a way of putting those commits into, you know, one or a smaller number of commits, which is like appropriate. And so they haven't ever done that before. And they're also busy. So about once a week, they'll like give it a try, leave a message like, hey, that didn't seem to work because I got this error message. And then I'll respond like, okay, well, you can fix that by doing this instead. And then they're like, cool, let's get back to it next week. And then, you know, so it's been like kind of outstanding, but someday we will get that pull request merged in of theirs. And so I think a lot of maintainers are also like just willing to help you through those kind of things. And it's okay if your pull requests sit open for a while. I've had pull requests open for as long as 2 years before somebody merged them in.
Did you forget about them?
I did too. I get a notification and someone was like, hey, I'm really sorry. I didn't have email notifications turned on. I never saw that you actually did this. I was looking at it again and then I realized there was something there. Thanks. And like, you know, So it's, sometimes if you work on smaller projects, people won't even notice, you know, what you've done. And that's unfortunate. I think I have one that's been open for 4 years now. Wow. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that project is completely abandoned because they also haven't updated it in almost 4 years. So it's maybe someday they'll come back to it. We'll see. But for now, it's just kind of hanging there in the ether.
So I think what you said was really important, where you said a lot of these projects are open source because they want your help. And I think it's important to remember, right? You are helping them. You are doing them a favor by donating your time and your skills and your effort. And so I think it might be hard to remember that, and it might feel like you're bothering someone, but really you're helping them.
Yep. And it's definitely true that there are some maintainers who are jerks. And so I don't want to say that it's always rosy and wonderful, but I generally have found that it's more wonderful than bad. And eventually, you know, it's like, it's difficult to say, well, if that person's being a jerk, then I don't care. So whatever. But like, you know, I'm not going to also tell you that every single project is wonderful, but I've generally found that the bigger projects get, the better they are because they've done it more times. You know, that's also part of it too. Like a big project, like with Rust, we have 10-ish new people show up every week.
Oh, wow.
So we're just really good at integrating new people into the project because that just happens a lot. And it's the same with other big projects like Rails as well. So it also kind of depends that way too. There are some big projects that aren't as good at doing it because they are so big, they're busy worried about their own things and not about helping new people out. But then at worst, it's just negligence, not being mean. So sometimes it can take some time to get a change in. I don't know. I don't want to say it's always wonderful, but like a lot of times it's totally much less scary than you would originally think.
That's good. That's good news.
Yeah.
Awesome. So next, let's move on to rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is...
I would say that the worst advice I've ever received is to not try something because it's hard.
People really told you that?
Yeah. So this actually comes up in programming a lot. It's not strictly a programming thing, but I've heard people say like, you shouldn't learn C because C is hard. Or you shouldn't learn assembly language because assembly language is hard. You shouldn't learn Haskell because Haskell is hard. But different people have different skills and abilities. And some people think that assembly language is easier than Ruby. Like those people exist. And it's because like to them, assembly language is very straightforward. There's a small number of commands. They do exactly what you say. You don't have to worry about inheritance and polymorphism and method calls and like all this other complicated stuff. It's just like very straightforward and simple. And so I found that usually when people say don't try something because it's hard, that they're forgetting that I'm different than them and I might not think it's hard. Hard things are worth trying anyway, because then if you succeed, you feel great about it.
That's true.
I've had bugs that I worked on for 6 months And it was very frustrating for those 6 months to find something. But when I did, it was like the best feeling. So I'd say that's probably the worst advice. I like to say that it did now. I think at the time, if you'd asked me 5.5 months in, like whether or not it was worth it, I probably would have been like, no, no. But now that it is, I'm like, yes, it definitely was.
Hindsight, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Number two, my first app was about?
My first app was a text adventure game.
Nice.
Very long time ago. So that was actually the first thing I'd ever done with computers was play. And like way back in the day, computers didn't have fancy graphics. And so instead of a 3D animated whatever, it was like you were in a room. There is water dripping down the walls of the cave. What would you like to do next? And you would type go east or go west or go north. And so that was the first thing I ever did with a computer. And I was really, really into it. So my first things I was working on with programs was trying to like recreate those games, basically.
What were your adventures?
So I really, really liked the Final Fantasy video games at the time. So I kind of like stole their universe and was always trying to make, these like wizards and mages and like swords. And it was very much like fantasy style things usually.
Did you ever get your friends to play it?
Yeah, I actually I sold one copy of my game for $5 to someone. Yeah, in high school.
That's awesome.
So it was really, really cool. And he had wanted it because that programming language, BASIC, there's no way to make it closed source. The only way that you get the programs is by trading the source code. And so he had like wanted to see how I had made the game. And so he's like, if I give you $5, will you give me this copy of the game? And I was like, sure, because I hadn't shared it with anyone. Because I was working on it, but I'd like told my friends at school or whatever. And so he offered and I was like, yeah, sure. That's awesome.
How old were you?
So 12, I want to say 13.
Very cool. Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is that it's hard and that people, even people who are experts in programming, don't know everything about programming. Like the programming field is super, super huge and people specialize in various things. And so even people that are really good at one particular area will not know anything about another area. And there's a lot of different stuff. So, and sort of related to that is it means that you can always be a beginner when you're programming, because if you get a different job and it uses a different kind of technology, you're back at square one and you have to learn something new, all over again. In a certain sense, like since my day job is working on this new programming language, Rust, like you could argue that every Rust programmer is a beginner Rust programmer because Rust has only really been usable in its current form for about a year.
Oh, wow.
So there's like,
oh, that's really new.
It's an 8-year old project, but we changed the language a lot over that time. So I'm going to say that like January was the first time that the language exists kind of as it does today, because we changed a lot of stuff the whole way up until the release date. May was the first time we had a 1.0. And so we changed all kinds of stuff. And so in the past, Rust was a very different language. So even people, so like I started using it in 2012, but it was a different language then. So really, I didn't start using it until January because you couldn't have because it was a different thing, So in a certain sense, like all programmers are beginners in this, when there's a new programming language or whatever. Or if you get a new job, you're a beginner again because maybe they use a different technology. Even if they use Rails, they might use a totally different set of gems that you've never seen before.
Yeah.
Or they're trying to do something in a different industry and now you have to relearn a new industry. That's actually one of the things I love about being a programmer is that you can end up learning about all this other stuff that's not programming.
Mm-hmm.
So like I've worked for a 3D printing company and I've worked for a financial credit card processing company and I've worked for a teaching company and all those things like require very different skills other than just the programming because you have to learn about the thing that you're building the app for. And so that's really exciting too.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like this idea that you get to learn about different industries and different fields. And really, you get to learn about people too, because you get to better understand how they work and what they do and how you can make their job a little bit easier.
Absolutely.
So next, let's do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
All right. Yeah, I have some shout outs. There's this book that I recently was sort of like the, I wasn't the editor. I was like the person they double checked. They like passed. I didn't write any of the book, but you know, they said like, could you review this and tell us what you think? And that book is called Ruby Wizardry. And it's published by No Starch Press. And it's a book focused on teaching Ruby to children. And I think that it is a really, really fantastic book at explaining the basics of learning programming in a very easy to understand way. Because, you know, when you're teaching children, you have to be simple because they're children. They haven't learned a whole lot yet, right? They're still in their educational, like, development. So I think that it might be a little too cartoony if you're an adult, maybe. But if you have the right kind of mindset, I think that even as an adult, it's a really good introduction to programming book. So that's really cool. A second book. Also by No Starch, they're like one of my favorite publishers, is If Hemingway Wrote JavaScript by Angus Kroll. And it's a book that says code is literature. Here's a small function in JavaScript, and here's how I would write it. Let's pretend that we are, I think it's 20 famous authors, and we'll rewrite the JavaScript code in the literary style that that author wrote their books in. So the Hemingway JavaScript is like very short and to the point and like uses small sentences, you know, in that kind of like sense. And there's all sorts of other, I think my favorite one is Tupac.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And so it's just really, really cool. And it shows you like how flexible programming can be and all the different ways, you know, it's one like 15 line long function, but there's 20 different versions of how you can write it. And it's in all these different styles. And so it really, really helps you, you know, like appreciate the breadth of programming, and just the style and setup is also just really, really wonderful. Sherlock Holmes is also really great. Like what if your function was a mystery book, you know, like that's kind of really cool. So yeah, I would say those are my two book shout outs. And the third one, the last one I'll do is, I've been trying to have non-programming hobbies lately because, like, you know, when we do so much open source, you're, like, working in programming all the time. And so there's this card game I've been playing called Netrunner, and it's about computer hackers, but it's not actually programming, so it counts as something different to me.
But the theme of
it barely counts. But the theme of the game is, like, your renegade hackers trying to hack into evil corporations' servers to steal their secrets. And so one side plays the corporations and one side plays the hacker. And it's very much like 1980s cyberpunk style themed. And so it's made by Fantasy Flight, the like board game company. So you buy a basic set and it gives you a deck of every, you know, every single faction. And then there's expansions that you can buy that give you more cards, basically. And so I found it to be like a lot of fun. And it's a really good game and helps me, you know, do non-programming stuff sometimes, even if it's themed like programming. It's cool.
Do you often get a chance to do non-programming things?
So I guess I have the chance, but a lot of times it's still like what I'm doing. I almost went to graduate school for English at one point. Yeah, I actually got accepted. I wrote a 20 or 30 page paper about how programming is literature, which maybe, you know, as the Hemingway JavaScript book, you know, gives away.
Yeah.
And so they accepted me, but they said, oh, by the way, we told you it was going to be free, but actually you're going to have to pay for it.
Oh.
And I was like, I don't have the money to pay for an English degree. Sorry. So I didn't actually go. Mm. But one of my hobbies is like pretending I'm actually an English major. So I try to read a lot of books. And so I sort of like try to pay attention to what's going on in the academic English world, which is like hard, but also there's some websites people like, you know, talk about things on, often weirdly enough, Facebook. There's like a bunch of professors on Facebook who talk about things all the time.
Really?
And so I haven't been doing as much of it lately, but I really like reading books, both like some fiction books, but also like philosophy books. So that's probably my biggest hobby outside of programming. And I've been too busy with programming to really pursue that as much in the last year or so, but I'm hoping this next year to like take some more time and make it more even and spend more time reading books because I love reading.
Yeah. So my problem is I feel like any time that I have to not code, I still want to code.
Yeah.
So that's the problem.
Yep. It's like you have to actively, especially when you feel passionate about it, you have to actively set aside time and be like, I am not going to program. I'm not going to check my email for GitHub notifications. Like, I'm just going to go do something else.
Just walk away. Yes. It's so hard to walk away. And I've got a few personal shout outs based on the theme of today's show. So one is OpenHatch. If you don't know OpenHatch, they are a really great nonprofit, and their goal is to get more people involved in open source. And they have a really great tool, a really great volunteer opportunity section on their website that we're going to link to in the show notes, where you can find different projects to work on based on languages, based on the type of bugs, based on the type of project, the type of the level of difficulty it's in. So it's a really great resource for a lot of you. I'm hoping that some of you are excited about contributing and looking for ways to get started. And I think this is a really great resource to help you do that. The second is a talk called Leveraging Open Source, Everything You Wanted to Know About Open Source That Nobody Told You, Including Getting Paid to Do It. And it's a really great video. It's a little long, but it's awesome. It gives you lots of great information on some of the buzzwords, the lingo, some of the tools that are used in the open source community, some of the good rules and etiquette that you should be aware of. It's a really great starting point to level up and to really get familiar with this community. And the third is a blog post that we actually wrote called What is Open Source? And it's a really great piece that we did about the history of open source, where it came from, where it is now. And it's done by one of our contributors, Ramsey Darling. And I encourage you all to check it out. It's really, really well done. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Steve, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Happy coding, everybody.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.